Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the ADA Legal Webinar Series, which is provided to you by the Great Lakes ADA Center, as well as the ADA National Network. We're pleased to have you join us today. This is a series that is offered 6 times a year and addresses a variety of different issues under the ADA as it relates to how case law is developing under the law. We're very pleased today to have our presenters, Barry Taylor and Rachel Beister, both with Equip for Equality, which is the Protection and Advocacy Agency for the State of Illinois. For those of you that have joined us in the past, Barry and Rachel have been a frequent presenter in this series and always get great reviews and have great information to be able to share with us. So at this time, I'm going to go ahead and hand over the microphone to Barry Taylor, who will start out our session. Barry, the microphone is yours.
Great. Thanks, Robin, and hello, everybody, and Happy New Year. Before we get too far into 2017, we wanted to review some of the top ADA cases of 2016. Before we do that, though, we want to remind you that this session is eligible for 1.5 hours of continuing legal education credit for Illinois attorneys. All you need to do, if you're an Illinois attorney who wants CLE, is just submit an email to me after the session confirming that you attended, and that email can be sent to barryt@equipforequality.org. If you're a non-attorney and you're looking for participant credit, you can contact Great Lakes on that, and the number is 877-232-1990. Or you can email them at webinars@ada-audio.org. And we'll repeat this slide at the end. So the way we're going to do today's session is we're first going to talk about the definition of disability and some of the cases that have come out in the last year. I'll start that part. And then Rachel will talk about some of the cases that have arisen under the employment provisions of the ADA, Title I. We'll take a break and see if we have any questions on those first two issues. And then we'll resume looking at Title II, State and Local Governments. I'll do that review. And then Rachel will close us up by looking at some of the new Title III cases, places of public accommodation, and then we'll see if anybody has questions about any of the issues that we raised today. And just want to remind people that, of course, we can't highlight all the important cases that have come down the past year in a 90-minute period, but what we've tried to do today is select a variety of cases that we think will be of interest. So as I said, we're going to first start with how some courts have been looking at the definition of disability. And as most of you know, after years of the courts interpreting the definition of disability overly narrowly, Congress passed the ADA Amendments Act in 2008 to ensure that courts would interpret the definition of disability in favor of broad coverage. And what we want to do today is to see how the courts are applying the ADA Amendments Act and the definition of disability. The first case we're going to look at is a Cannon case out of Texas, and this was a case involving an applicant who had applied for a field engineer position at a mining site, and he had a torn rotator cuff. And as a result of that torn rotator cuff, he couldn't raise his arm above his shoulder, and it limited his ability to push and pull. Well, he went through the interview process and received a conditional job offer, and then he underwent a pre-employment examination. And the doctor who conducted the examination cleared the employee. He said he's going to have some restrictions. He can't lift or pull anything over 10 pounds, and he shouldn't be working with his hands over his shoulder. After that report came through, the job offer was revoked. And so Mr. Cannon filed suit under the ADA, and once he filed suit, the employer then moved for summary judgment, alleging that Mr. Cannon did not have an ADA disability, and therefore there was no discrimination. And the Texas District Court actually agreed with the employer and granted summary judgment, say the case should not go forward because the plaintiff could not prove he had a disability under the ADA because his limitations weren't substantially limiting. And the plaintiff appealed that to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals actually found for the employee. They reversed the finding below, and they found that the district court, the decision it had issued was at odds with the ADA Amendments Act. One of the reasons we wanted to highlight this case is because it provides a discussion of some important ADA Amendments Act principles. One is the court reiterates that substantial limits no longer demands extensive analysis and that you need to compare the employee with the general population. And here, the court found that it was undisputed that the employee's shoulder impairment was, in fact, substantially limiting. The employee and the doctor said he couldn't lift his arm above his shoulders, unlike people in the general population, and that he had considerable difficulty when lifting, pushing, or pulling objects with that arm where the rotator cuff injury was. And therefore, he had an actual disability that substantially limited his major life activities. The court also said that there was evidence that the employee was regarded as disabled because as soon as the report about his physical was given to the employer, within 2 hours, the job offer was revoked. And that indicated that there was a perception that he was not able to do the job, and they revoked the offer, and they perceived him as having a disability. And, you know, this is a good example, I think, of how the ADA Amendments Act really made a difference. Before the ADA Amendments Act, this person may not have been covered because they couldn't show they had substantial limitation in a major life activity because of the narrow way they were viewing the ADA definition of disability at the time. But here, once the court properly applied the new standard under the ADA Amendments Act, the case was allowed to proceed and he was found to have an actual disability. The next case has more of a focus on the regarded as component of the definition of disability, the Alexander case. And this is a case out of the District of Columbia, and you had an employee here who had alcoholism. And you remember that a person with alcoholism has been deemed covered by the ADA, so you can't exclude people with alcoholism, but you can have conduct rules like no drinking at work. And so in this particular case, this person was under the influence of alcohol while he was at work. He was suspended and referred to the employee assistance program at work. And under the employee assistance program, they said he would be allowed to return to work, but he would be subjected to periodic alcohol tests. Unfortunately for him, he failed those tests and ultimately was fired. As he was being fired, though, he was told that he could reapply within 1 year if he completed an intensive alcohol dependency treatment program. So the employee did what he was told. He completed that program and reapplied, but he was not rehired. And so he filed suit under the ADA, and he alleged that he was told that he was not rehired because he had failed the EAP, he had violated the alcohol policy. And in fact, they said that one of the supervisors said, well, if we let you back, it's going to open the floodgates for people like you, you know, implying people with alcoholism. And so the district court, when the case was brought, found that the employer should prevail, and that the reason being that alcoholism did not substantially limit one or more major life activities. So the plaintiff appealed that to the district court level, and again, the district court applied the ADA Amendments Act correctly, reversed and found for the employee. And in this analysis, they primarily focused on the fact that the employee was regarded as having a disability. And let's look at what they did. You know, this case has some important language about regarded as prong and reminds us how things are different under the ADA Amendments Act. And that really that after the ADA Amendments Act, regarded as prong can now be the primary way people like Mr. Alexander can be covered by the ADA. You no longer have to necessarily use the actual disability or the record of prong if you can meet the regarded as prong. And here, what the court reminded us is that when you have a claim that's based on regarded as or perceived impairment, you no longer have to prove that the plaintiff was regarded as being substantially limited in a particular major life activity. You only have to show that it was an impairment and they were treated differently because of the actual or perceived impairment. Remember before, you had to get inside the mind of the employer and say, well, did they perceive him as being impaired in a particular major life activity? And that was virtually impossible to get inside the mind of the employer about how they perceived and what major life activity it was. Here, it's more just, did they have a prohibited action terminating him because of an actual perceived impairment, the alcoholism? And they found that that was the case here. The court also went on to find that even if in addition to meeting the regarded as component of the definition of disability, the plaintiff also met the actual disability and record of because he was substantially limited in many major life activities. So I guess the advocacy tip here for people with disabilities to remember is to, if applicable, to plead all three prongs of the definition of disability, actual disability, record of, and regarded as, with regarded as being the easiest one to satisfy because you don't have to show a substantial limitation in a particular major life activity. The last issue I'm going to cover, and then I'll turn it over to Rachel, is an issue that comes up every now and then, and it did come up again in 2016, and that is the question is, obesity a disability, and has that changed now that we have the 80 Amendments Act? And the Morris case is one of the latest in sort of a long line of cases looking at this issue. So in the Morris case, the plaintiff had been given a conditional offer of a job for a machinist position, and the offer was, however, contingent on satisfying a medical review. And this particular company required applicants who had safety-sensitive jobs, which apparently a machinist position was, to have what's called a body mass index, which is a height-weight ratio used as an indicator for obesity. You had to have a body mass index under 40. And Mr. Morris's body mass index was at 40.9, so it was above a 40 because he was 5 feet 10 inches and weighed 270 pounds. He admitted on the application that he had no underlying medical condition that contributed to his obesity. And after he undertook that examination and got the BMI score of over 40.40, his job offer was revoked. He then filed suit under the ADA, and the Nebraska District Court found for the employer, saying that he did not have a disability, that obesity did not fall within the ADA. And so the question on appeal at the Eighth Circuit is, was obesity a disability under the ADA? And the Eighth Circuit said, you know, for obesity to be covered by the ADA, you have to have an underlying physiological disorder, because if you look at the definition of disability under the ADA, it says a physical or mental impairment. So obesity has to have some sort of corresponding physiological disorder. And the court went on to say that, you know, if you look at the ADA statute itself, it doesn't even define physical impairment. And so the ADA statute didn't help. But if you look at the EEOC's regulations, it does define impairment as a physiological disorder or condition affecting one or more body systems. And they felt that because it required the EEOC's regulations define impairment to require a physiological disorder, and the plaintiff here, he said he had no underlying disorder, he was just significantly overweight, he wouldn't be covered by the ADA. The plaintiff here tried to say, well, look at the EEOC's interpretive guidance. They say that an impairment doesn't include physical characteristics of weight if you're within a normal range and not the result of physiological disorder. So the plaintiff was saying you only require a physiological impairment if you're within that normal range of weight. But if you're outside of it, you wouldn't have to have a physical impairment associated with the obesity. And the Eighth Circuit said, you know, that's a sort of a tortured reading of that regulation. We believe that it means you have to have a physiological disorder in every case. And the plaintiff said, well, wait a second. Look at the EEOC's compliance manual. It says specifically that severe obesity or body weight more than 100% over the norm is a disability. And the Eighth Circuit said, well, you know, that manual contradicts the plain language of the ADA and its regulations and therefore is not entitled to deference. We're not going to rely upon that. And in fact, the court said we're even going to look at the pre-ADA Amendments Act cases for reaching our decision because when Congress changed the ADA amendments, changed the ADA through the ADA Amendments Act, it revised the definition of substantial limits and major life activities, but they made no changes to impairment. And since we're really focused on impairment, we can look at old ADA cases as well as new ADA Amendments Act cases in reaching our decision. The court said we're also not going to find that he's regarded as having an impairment under the regarded as because, again, he doesn't have an impairment, and regarded as requires you to have either a real or perceived impairment. And the plaintiff himself says he has no impairment. So what we now have is what we call a circuit split, meaning that we have courts across the country who are coming down on different sides of this question. You have some courts like the Morris case as well as the Watkins and Francis case cited at the top of the slide that obesity without a physiological condition is not an impairment and therefore can't be a disability. But then you have other courts that are saying that, well, if you're outside the normal range of weight, you have morbid obesity, you don't need an underlying impairment. And you see the EEOC versus Res for Human Development case as well as the Whitaker case that talk about that and rely upon the EEOC's interpretive guidance that I mentioned before. So they're giving deference to the EEOC in these cases, whereas the other ones are saying, We don't need to look at the EEOC's interpretive guidance. You have to have an impairment based on the statute and the regulations. So when we have these kinds of splits, sometimes it looks like those are the kind of cases that the Supreme Court will take and try to resolve the split so that we have uniform application of a principle across the country. And in fact, this case was sent up to the Supreme Court for a request for review, but the Supreme Court denied the request for review, and so therefore the split will not be resolved in Morris, and we're going to sort of have this different application of obesity and the ADA across the country until we get either something statutory change that clarifies it further, or we have a resolution by the U.S. Supreme Court. So definitely a stay tuned kind of situation on this continuing issue. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Rachel to talk about the next set of cases under Title I.
Thanks so much, Gary, and hello to everyone. So we're going to start our employment section today with a case called Flynn versus Distinctive Home Care, which is out of the Fifth Circuit. And this case addresses who can file an employment discrimination case under the Rehabilitation Act. So this case, the plaintiff is a pediatrician who was recently diagnosed with autism, and the pediatrician believed he was discriminated against. However, unlike many ADA cases, the plaintiff was not an employee of the defendant. He was instead an independent contractor. So with quick background, Title I of the ADA applies only to employees. So because of that, Flynn was unable to bring a case under the ADA. So what did he do? Instead, he decided to file his employment discrimination case under Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. And as a reminder, the language of the Rehab Act says that it protects disabled persons in federally assisted programs or activities. So what happened? Well, at first, the case went to the district court, and the district court said that independent contractors like Flynn cannot file suit under Section 504 and dismiss the case. So why did it do that? Well, the Rehabilitation Act has a provision stating in it that it incorporates some of Title I of the ADA standards. And so based on that, they said that Section 504 was also incorporating the definition of employer. Well, Flynn appealed, and the case went to the Fifth Circuit, and the Fifth Circuit reversed that decision, found for Flynn, and said, no, independent contractors are able to sue. They can sue under Section 504. The Fifth Circuit explained that the Rehabilitation Act is a really broad law. It covers all programs and activities, and while it did incorporate some language of Title I, it incorporated the substantive standards. So in other words, the Rehab Act looked at Title I to decide what conduct violates the law, but it doesn't look to Title I to determine who is covered by the law, so it's incorporating the substantive standards only. And there's not a universal answer to the question of whether independent contractors can sue under Section 504. And this slide highlights the circuit split on the issue. As Barry explained before, we've got the circuit split where some circuits are saying, yes, we have independent contractors that can sue under Section 504, and other circuits saying, no, they cannot. So the examples we have here are the Schrader case and the Fleming case, saying that from the Ninth Circuit and the Tenth Circuit, and these are ones that are siding with the Fifth Circuit in the Flynn case that we just talked about, saying, yes, independent contractors can sue under Section 504. But then we have a case out of the Eighth Circuit, the Wojcicki case, that said that independent contractors cannot sue and incorporated that definition of employer. So this is another case, like Barry mentioned, that we've got the circuit split. Potentially it's an issue that we'll see go all the way up to the Supreme Court. But we did want to note that after that Ninth Circuit case and Fleming was decided, the hospital actually did petition for Supreme Court review, and the Supreme Court denied cert. So this is another interesting issue to watch, and we'll definitely see, depending on how additional circuits make decisions moving forward, whether it's something that ends up before the Supreme Court. So speaking of circuit splits, our next issue is something that we've spoken about pretty regularly on these webinars, and that's the issue of reassignment as a reasonable accommodation. So as a reminder, the ADA says that reassignment to a vacant position for which an employee is qualified is a reasonable accommodation. But the question is, well, does this mean that the employee has the right to be placed in the vacant position, or do they have the right to compete for the vacant position? Now, currently, the majority rule is that reassignment to a vacant position without competition is reasonable, so long as the employer, there's no undue hardship and the employer doesn't have a seniority system. And at least three circuits have held that, the Seventh Circuit in the United case, which came out a couple years ago, and then the Smith case out of the Tenth Circuit and the ACCA case out of the D.C. Circuit. And up until a few months ago, the only circuit finding that employers can make reassignment competitive was the Eighth Circuit decision in Huber versus Walmart. And this case was actually questionable because it had relied on reasoning from a Seventh Circuit case that's now been overruled. Another reason this Huber case out of the Eighth Circuit was somewhat questionable is that the Supreme Court actually agreed to hear this case following the decision, but the parties ended up settling, and so the case was dismissed as moot at that point. So our update for 2016 is that another circuit, the 11th Circuit, joined the 8th Circuit to find that reassignment can be competitive. And this is the case EEOC versus St. Joseph's Hospital. And here, the EEOC brought a case about a nurse who had developed spinal stenosis, arthritis, and as a result, she started to use a cane. Well, this ended up causing an issue for her employer because she was working as a nurse in a psychiatric ward, and the employer said that the cane could be used as a weapon, and so she was no longer able to work in her current job. So what the hospital did is they said, okay, you have 30 days to try to find an alternate position, but you have to compete for the job. Well, we're here because the nurse tried to find another job, and she wasn't able to find one and was ultimately fired. So the EEOC filed this lawsuit and said that this action violated the ADA, and it did so because the employer was requiring the nurse to compete for a vacant position when the EEOC identified three different positions that they said that the nurse was qualified for but wasn't even interviewed for and definitely not placed in those positions. So the case first went to the district court, and the district court agreed with the hospital and said, no, the ADA does not require employers to reassign employees without competition. So then the case went to trial, and the court instructed the jury to say that it was reasonable to give the employee 30 days to try to find another job. This case ended up being appealed, and the 11th Circuit ultimately came to that same conclusion. It said that the ADA does not require reassignment without competition, and it called that type of request preferential treatment. Now, in making this decision, the 11th Circuit cited that 8th Circuit Huber case we were just talking about, and it also looked at the ADA's statutory language and said, while the ADA says that reassignment may be a reasonable accommodation, but it didn't say it must be a reasonable accommodation. Also contributing to the 11th Circuit's opinion, it looked at the Supreme Court case Barnett versus U.S. Airways, and it interpreted that case in a way that's different than some of our other circuits have interpreted it. And what the 11th Circuit said is that when you have an employer who has a policy, a best qualified policy, which means that the employer has a policy to hire the best qualified applicant, that under this Barnett, the Supreme Court case, it's not reasonable to violate this policy in the run of cases. And the 11th Circuit said, you know, the case before them was a case about a hospital. And so while that's always true, or usually true, it's especially true in hospitals where we need the best personnel. However, this case was not all bad news for the EEOC. The court did emphasize that there could be cases where reassignment would supersede a best qualified hiring policy if there are some special circumstances that warrant it. And the court also affirmed some of the jury's and the lower court's findings that were pro-employee, but those were ones that didn't ultimately contribute to the legal conclusion in this case. So what's the impact of this decision? Well, again, now that we've got this more clear circuit split and the fact that the Supreme Court has previously suggested that it might be interested in reviewing this legal issue, this is definitely an issue that we may see some Supreme Court action on in the next few years. Our next case is a quick update on a case that we discussed last year, and it's also a case about reassignment. So this is the Riazuddin case out of the Fourth Circuit, and this, to give a quick refresher on the facts, this case, we had an employee who was blind, and she worked as an information and referral aide for Montgomery County. Well, the county had started using a new call center. They consolidated all their call centers, but the problem for the plaintiff was that the call center started to use inaccessible software and she wasn't able to use it. So all of her coworkers were all transferred and sent to start working at the center, but the plaintiff was not transferred. Instead, she was able to keep her same job and keep her benefits and her grade, but she didn't have much work to do. Her supervisors spent a lot of time struggling and trying to find work. So the question we looked at last year was, okay, well, is this a violation of the ADA? She wasn't transferred, but she didn't lose any pay, salary, or benefits. But the Fourth Circuit last year said, yes, this was, you know, this could be an ADA violation. And the reason why was that the county just cobbled together some make-work tasks. And this was an important decision because it held that even though an employer may provide an alternate accommodation, it has to still be a meaningful employment opportunity. And here, the fact that these tasks were just cobbled together wasn't meaningful. So at that point, the case was remanded for trial, and our 2016 update is that the case did, in fact, go to trial. There was a two-week trial with five-day jury deliberations, and in February of last year, the jury found for the plaintiff. The jury found that the county did discriminate against her for failing to transfer her to the call center because of the inaccessible software. The jury also concluded that the county could have provided a reasonable accommodation and that it wouldn't have posed an undue hardship to make that software accessible. So that was a big win for the plaintiff in this case. And where we're at now is that the court has to decide injunctive relief moving forward. And the case is still being litigated because the county has asked the court to dismiss the case, saying that it should be moot at this point because it's already transferred her with accommodations and full-time work. And the plaintiff disputes that and says that the accommodations are inadequate and is still not being accommodated. And so stay tuned. Perhaps next year we'll have another update on what's happened in this case. Our next case, the Camp versus Bylo case out of the Sixth Circuit, is a helpful reminder about how we can determine what are essential job functions. Here in the Camp case, we have an individual who has a back impairment, and this individual worked as a stock clerk for 38 years. And much of this time, he worked on a small team with two other employees, and together they were responsible for stocking the grocery with product on a nightly basis. So there's always been this informal arrangement where the plaintiff's coworkers helped lift some very heavy items. And on one occasion, the team was unable to stock everything, and so they explained that they needed help, a little help, because of the plaintiff's bad back. Well, at this point, the employer said to the employee, look, I'm giving you this job description. And the job description says that lifting 20 to 60 pounds frequently is an essential function of the job. So what I want you to do is go to your doctor and have the doctor certify that you can do all of these job restrictions. Well, the doctor responded and said, no, I'm restricting this employee from lifting over 35 pounds as a result of his back. Well, after those restrictions were more formalized, the employee was placed on a short-term disability. He asked, he said, you know, I've been doing this informal arrangement where I work together on this team. Can we continue that? And he was told no, and eventually he was let go. So the question before the district court was, is lifting an essential job function? And the district court found that it was, and it relied heavily on that job description. But this is something we see time and time again, where there's this over-reliance of job descriptions, where if you'll recall, when determining whether or not any particular function is an essential function, there's a whole host of different factors that we look at, and the job description is only one of these factors. And so when this case went up to the Sixth Circuit, the Sixth Circuit said that, no, when you look at all of these factors, lifting over 35 pounds was not an essential function. And what the Sixth Circuit did was really just look at what's happened over the past, you know, 38 years. There's been this three-man team that's been able to shelve product. The plaintiff has been able to fulfill his duties for years, and it also credited the testimony from the supervisors and colleagues. And so this case is a great reminder to both employees and employers that job descriptions are very helpful in determining what functions are essential, but they're not determinative and the only factor. Another interesting employment case from 2016 is the Searles versus Johns Hopkins Hospital case out of Maryland. In this case, questioned whether or not having a full-time sign language interpreter was a reasonable accommodation under the ADA. So here we have a recent nursing grad who had actually spent a couple of rotations at Johns Hopkins Hospital with interpreters. And she's someone who better understands using an interpreter, but voices for herself and also reads does some lip reading. So now this individual applied for a nursing position, and this position required, and I quote, highly effective verbal communication and interpersonal skills. Well, the hospital thought she was qualified, gave her an offer contingent on a health screening, and it was at that point where the nurse asked for a full-time sign language interpreter. The hospital actually at that point rescinded her offer and said that they could not provide the interpreter because it would pose an undue hardship. And the reason they figured out it was an undue hardship is they said that, well, the nurse makes between $40,000 and $60,000 annually, and an interpreter would cost $120,000. After that job was rescinded, the nurse found another job and has been working successfully, but still filed a lawsuit against Johns Hopkins. And in this case, the court actually found for the employee and granted summary judgment to the nurse. We think this is particularly interesting because summary judgment is rarely granted to plaintiffs in ADA cases, but here it was granted, finding that the plaintiff had established her claim as a matter of law. And so what the court said is they made a number of different findings. One is the court explained that the interpreter request was reasonable. They said, look, you know, the ADA itself specifically lists interpreters as possible accommodations, and it was very telling that this particular nurse has successfully used interpreters in the past, including at the very hospital that she was filing this lawsuit against now. The court also explained that the use of an interpreter wasn't going to require the nurse to give up any of her essential job functions. You know, with an interpreter, she was still able to communicate with patients, family, personnel, and in fact, you needed the nurse because if you took away the nurse, it's not as if the interpreter would be able to act independently. The interpreter was only interpreting what the nurse was communicating. The court also said there was no undue hardship. And reemphasize something when we're determining undue hardship is it gave a good reminder that we need to look at the overall budget. We can't just look and compare the cost of the interpreter to the nurse's salary. Instead, we need to look at the overall budget. And so while the interpreter might cost double the nurse's salary, it was only 0.007% of the hospital's overall budget. And so finally, the court also looked at whether or not there was a direct threat by allowing this nurse to work, given that there were some auditory alarms. And the court dismissed that argument and said this is a post hoc rationalization without an individualized assessment, something that just has never been mentioned before and just came up by the hospital when trying to defend itself in this litigation. So our last employment topic is one that we've seen a lot of action on lately, and that is the issue of wellness plans. So I want to start with a little bit of background. Many employers sponsor wellness plans to promote healthy living, and many of these programs require employees to submit to medical examinations or inquiries. Some employers provide incentives for participating in wellness plans, including greatly reduced healthcare costs. And the reason we're talking about this issue is, as a reminder, the ADA prohibits employers from requiring medical exams or making disability-related inquiries of employees unless they're job-related and consistent with business necessity. And so here, there's two exceptions to that general rule. One is employers can make these require these exams or make these inquiries if the information is provided on a voluntary basis. And two, there's an exception, it's called the safe harbor provision, that medical exams and inquiries are okay as long as they have as long as they're part of an insurance related issue, but it has to, we'll talk about this in a moment, it has to be tied in a very specific way to the underwriting and assessment of insurance. And so both of these exceptions have been litigated by the EEOC recently about wellness plans. So we're going to talk about a couple of cases, but first I wanted to also note that in 2016, the EEOC released final rules about wellness programs and addressed both of these exceptions. So we've got links on the slide to both the regulations and to a question and answer document that's particularly helpful on wellness plans. So before we talk about the cases, there are two parts of these regulations that I want to highlight to give some background on the cases. So the first part of these new rules is a regulation that says that information gathered as part of a wellness plan does not fall within that safe harbor provision. In other words, it's not permissible to ask, you know, disability-related questions as part of a wellness plan. And that's part of these new EEOC regulations. The second part of the EEOC regulations I want to mention is that they help us understand what voluntary means. They say that employers can offer incentives, but they cap the incentives. So they can offer financial incentives, but it's capped at 30% of the total cost for self-only coverage. And anything over that 30% amount is no longer considered voluntary. So with those two parts of the regulations in mind, let's move on and talk about a couple of cases. The first case we want to flag is AARP versus EEOC, and this was a case that was filed last October in the DC courts. And the AARP filed a complaint and motion for a preliminary injunction, and they actually were asking the court to prevent or to stop the EEOC regulations from going into effect on January 1st of this year. And one of the biggest issues that the AARP had with the regulations was this new definition of voluntary. The AARP argued that, yes, there's a 30% cap, but by permitting employers to offer financial incentives up to that 30% cap, the EEOC regulations are conflicting with the ADA because they're still permitting very heavy financial penalties on employees who decline to share this medical information. So that was the basis of their complaint, but just before the new year, on December 29th, the court denied AARP's request for a preliminary injunction, saying that the AARP failed to demonstrate irreparable harm or likelihood of success on the merits. So this case is continuing. There's still going to be a final decision after some additional briefing, but that's kind of where we are now on that case. There are two other cases we wanted to highlight about wellness plans that the EEOC has been litigating. And the first is EEOC versus Flambeau, where the EEOC, again, is challenging an employer's wellness plan as violative of the ADA. This case was decided before the EEOC issued its new regulations, and what happened in this case is that the district court ultimately said that the wellness plan was okay because it fell within the ADA safe harbor provision. And again, the reasoning of the district court was that the wellness plan was used to underwrite, classify, or administer risks associated with the self-funded plan. And after that decision, the EEOC appealed, and a Seventh Circuit decision is expected this year. But remember, this, again, was decided before the regulations, and now it's clear from the EEOC regulations that wellness plans cannot fall within the safe harbor provision. So this is definitely a case to watch, and it'll be interesting to see how the Seventh Circuit addresses that issue. Our final wellness plan case from 2016 is EEOC versus Orion Energy Systems, which is out of the Eastern District of Wisconsin. And here we have a similar fact pattern to the ones we've seen on wellness plans, where an employer has a wellness plan, but they offer financial incentives, and so employees who opt out of the wellness plan that requires some medical information to be shared have to pay a financial penalty. And here the financial penalty was pretty hefty. They had to pay the entire monthly health insurance premium, which ranged from $413 to over $1,100 a month. So Orion, the employer, argued this wellness plan was permissible under the ADA, and it cited both of those two exceptions we discussed earlier. It said, it said that it was both subject to the safe harbor provision and it was a voluntary program. Well, the court agreed partially with that reasoning, but it agreed partially with the EEOC as well. So let's start with the safe harbor provision. So unlike the Flambeau case we just referenced, the court here found that the safe harbor provision did not apply. And there were a couple different reasons for that. So the first, remember we just talked about the EEOC's new regulations that say safe harbor provisions do not apply to wellness plans. Well, the court said that this particular regulatory provision was retroactive, so it applied to this case. So even though this plan was in place before the regs came out, it was going to apply, and therefore the safe harbor provision could not be used. But the court said, you know, look, even if we don't rely on the EEOC's new regulation, the safe harbor provision still doesn't apply because that exception is extremely limited. It's really related only to the basic underwriting and risk classification of insurance, and that wasn't the case here. So that wasn't the safe harbor provision was not applicable. However, the court ultimately found that the wellness plan still was permissible and agreed with the employer, and the reason why is they found it was voluntary. And the court's decision takes a very, very literal reading of the word voluntary. It says, yes, even though individuals had to pay these very high amounts, they had the option to participate or not. And so they were not forced to participate. They were just given a very strong incentive to do so. The court even said the choice may have been a difficult one, but it is a choice nonetheless. So again, now remember the EEOC regulations moving forward put this 30% cap on the payments. And so as a result, we're unlikely to see cases like this moving forward, but I think it's an important case to highlight to show kind of what the state of the law is and was before the EEOC regulations came into effect. And you may be wondering why there is this retroactivity argument with the safe harbor provision, but not with the 30% cap. And I'm not sure everything about that, but the court did say that the parties did not argue that the 30% cap was retroactive. So that issue didn't come up with the 30% cap. So again, some pretty interesting employment issues and ones that, you know, a few issues that we want to definitely keep an eye on moving forward. So with that, I think we're going to allow about 5 minutes for questions if anybody has, and then Barry will take it away and start with Title II.
And so far, at least in the chat box, I don't see any questions have been submitted. Remember, folks can just submit your questions in the chat box or type Control-M and enter text in the chat area. And as Robin explained at the beginning, if you're not logged in on the webinar and you want to submit a question by email, you send those to webinars@ada-audio.org. Robin, have you received any email questions yet?
No, Barry, we don't have any at this time.
Well, why don't we go ahead and we'll move on to Title II, and people can submit your questions in the chat box, and then we'll make sure we have time at the end to answer questions that people have on anything that we've raised. So let's move on to Title II, which covers state and local governments. And the first case we're going to talk about is a new Olmstead case. Remember, Olmstead's the Supreme Court case that says that unjustified institutionalization is discrimination under the ADA. And most of the cases after Olmstead were focused on this whole housing issue, where people were living and whether it was integrated or not. But what we've seen over the years is that Olmstead's been applied to other contexts as well, including the issue of integrated employment, and now integrated education. And that's the case we're going to talk about that was filed in 2016. And that's the case of United States versus Georgia. And in this case, it was filed in the same state where Olmstead was filed, interestingly. And the issue here is Georgia's what's called the Network for Educational and Therapeutic Support Program, or GNETS program. And Georgia has this GNETS program that serves thousands of students almost exclusively in segregated programs in self-contained buildings or separate wings. DOJ alleged that the education provided is inferior to that provided to kids in integrated setting. They have a lack of access to a variety of things and inferior facilities. And DOJ, before filing suit, issued what it's called a letter of findings, which talked about how the program violated the ADA's integration mandate that people with disabilities, including students with disabilities, be served in the most integrated setting. Well, after they filed that, they issued the letter of finding, they ultimately decided to file suit. Weren't able to resolve the issues with Georgia and filed suit in August of 2016. And basically they were alleging that the state was violating the ADA in a number of ways that is consistent with the ADA and the Supreme Court's decision in Olmstead about failing to serve students in the most integrated setting, placing other students at risk of segregation, providing unequal educational opportunities, and failing to modify policies to avoid discrimination. And you'll see a link at the bottom of this slide, 38, that you can go to see the actual complaint if you want that level of detail. The case is sort of at an interesting status, though, because instead of sort of saying we didn't discriminate, the state has filed a motion to dismiss on other issues as well. One issue that they're raising is that the Department of Justice lacks a standing to sue. And what they're saying is that DOJ does not have the authority to file litigation, affirmative litigation, under Title II of the ADA. And that basis is because if you look at the actual language of Title I, Title II, and Title III, for some reason in Title I and Title III, it specifically references the Attorney General and Department of Justice being able to affirmatively enforce those titles. But in Title II, it doesn't reference specifically the Department of Justice or the Attorney General, and just says that persons can enforce Title II. And so Georgia is trying to argue that because it doesn't specifically authorize in that particular part the Department of Justice to bring affirmative litigation, they can't bring litigation under Title II, including Olmstead-based litigation. And they're bringing this argument because a similar argument was successful in a Florida case, CV versus Dudek. And so Georgia's trying to make the same argument. A lot of folks who've weighed in on this. There's amicus briefs that have been filed by many different organizations saying why this argument is nonsensical, and DOJ certainly has the authority to do so. But because at least one court has looked at this, this is an issue that seems to be percolating that we really need to look at closely. And, you know, if this standing argument ultimately is successful, the court won't really get to the underlying Olmstead claim because only Department of Justice is the plaintiff here. There are no other plaintiffs, so the case would go away. Others could file, of course. But, you know, the long-term issue I think that we want to watch for is, you know, is this a new trend that we're going to be seeing other courts looking at? Because if so, it wouldn't just be about Title II Olmstead cases, but really other Title II issues as well. And so something carefully to watch, and of course we have a new administration coming in, and where DOJ is going to be going is also an open issue that we should all be paying attention to over the next several years. We now want to focus on Title II and emergency preparedness. And you recall in the past we've talked about emergency preparedness under Title II with respect to municipalities requirements. And we thought this case that we're going to talk about today is interesting because it's applied to the school setting as opposed to a broader municipality. I'm going to try to pronounce this case's name, the plaintiff Jagielski Basel versus Los Angeles Unified School District. I apologize for butchering that name if I did. And this was a complaint against a school that served deaf and hard of hearing students. And the case was actually brought by the plaintiffs were staff at the school who were deaf and hard of hearing themselves. And what had happened was they had emergency information about that would come over the standard PA system, but deaf and hard of hearing teachers and staff, you know, really couldn't understand what was going on, and so they weren't effective in addressing any emergencies that came up through this oral process. And after the litigation was filed in 2015, a settlement was reached in 2016. And it's a very extensive settlement. We've got a link on the next page. But some of the highlights is they are agreeing to put in a new visual PA system with large HD screens, scrolling LCD display, video phones added to classrooms and common areas that are going to enable people to communicate better. They'll also be having flashing alarm systems to differentiate between different kinds of emergencies and what to do. So if it's an evacuation, it'll be a certain type of flashing alarm system. And if it's a situation where people need to stay where they are, known as shelter in place, it'll be a different type of flashing alarm. Before, it was one type of alarm or just done orally, and deaf and hard of hearing teachers didn't know which way to go. This will allow them to say, oh, it's this kind of flashing system, we need to stay where we are, or it's this kind of flashing system, we need to get the kids out of school right away. You'll see on the screen this slide a number of other types of changes that are going to be made, including developing a video in American Sign Language that describes the emergency procedures at the school and other things that are going to make it much easier for deaf and hard of hearing teachers to assist when emergencies arise. And as I said, there is a link at the bottom where you can get a copy of the actual settlement if you want that level of detail. We've also talked in previous webinars about cases involving the accessibility of in-person voting and whether being able to vote privately and independently when you go and vote, primarily this arises for blind people, is something that is actionable under the ADA when the only way to vote is when you're blind is by getting assistance from someone else. And what we're going to talk about today is sort of a tangent from that and looking at the issue of accessibility of absentee voting. And this arose in a case out of Maryland, National Federation of the Blind versus Lamone. And in this case, the Maryland voters generally all Maryland voters can obtain absentee ballots a number of ways, mail, fax, or downloading the ballot. And if you download the ballot, you can't really fill it out online. You actually have to print the ballot, mark your choices, sign, and return. So as a result, blind voters and others with disabilities would need assistance, and they're not able to vote privately and independently like non-disabled voters, so other people would be able to know who they voted for because it wasn't an accessible tool. It turns out, though, that Maryland had developed an online ballot tool so people could mark their choices electronically, but they had not implemented it. They had tested it out in 2012, but had not implemented it as a going forward. And so the plaintiffs here, National Federation of the Blind, some individuals, filed a lawsuit saying that the Maryland absentee voting program did violate the ADA. While the lawsuit was pending, the Board of Elections in Maryland tried to approve the accessible electronic tool that I referenced before, but because it required a supermajority of the Board of Elections and somebody was absent, it did not pass, so it wasn't implemented. So the case went to trial in 2014, and they found for the plaintiffs, and the state appealed, and then the Fourth Circuit in 2016 affirmed the decision for the plaintiffs. And they talked about, you know, when we're talking about meaningful access, we're talking about meaningful access to absentee voting, not just generally voting. So Maryland was saying, well, there's accessible voting. If you go in person, you can use electronic machines and vote independently and privately. That should be enough. And the court said, no, you need to have meaningful access to all aspects of voting, including the absentee voting process, just like non-disabled people do. And they have some really very, very strong language, like one of the bullet points says, voting is a quintessential public activity that helps ensure that people with disabilities are never relegated to a position of political powerlessness. So really strong language promoting the concept that meaningful access means not just the ability to vote, but the ability to vote independently and privately. And so they said that modifying the ballot program to implement this electronic program that they'd already been working on was not a fundamental alteration. It was already developed and had been deemed accessible and secure. And the fact that you had the state law requirement of a supermajority didn't win the day because the supremacy clause means that the ADA trumps the state law requirement. Interestingly, there was a similar case that was decided in Ohio that went a different way. It was a case again involving people not having accessible absentee voting systems. But here the court found that using the proposed tool that Maryland was using or other ones that were out there would be a fundamental alteration because they had not gone through the certification process. And here Ohio said, you know, this is different than Maryland, which had been working on this voting system, had tested it out, it was deemed accessible and secure, and was ready to go. The system in Ohio had not been even tried, and they felt like dumping this into the middle of an election season was really a fundamental alteration and was not something they were going to force Ohio to do. They encouraged Ohio to work on it, but they weren't going to require them to do it right away. But I think the key point here is that even though they didn't require them to do it right away, they did recognize that that the right to accessible absentee balloting is something that's covered under the ADA. They just need to figure out a way to do it in a timely, thoughtful manner. And it was really more of a timing issue than disagreeing with the underlying argument that the ADA covers absentee balloting. So something to watch out. I think we're going to see this in a lot of other states given the different types of absentee balloting that's going on across the country. For the remainder of the cases, I'm going to talk about the interplay between Title II and law enforcement, because this is a very timely issue. We've had a lot of these kinds of cases arising with respect to people with disabilities and other groups, and we want to show how the ADA plays in these types of things. So the next case I'm going to talk about, Estate of Salar versus Regal Cinemas, is probably one of the most tragic cases I've ever read. It gets me every time I read it, and I'll share with you this case, and it is very, very sad. It involved a man who was a 26-year-old man with Down syndrome, and he went to go see a movie at the theater with an aide, and after the movie was over, he liked it so much he wanted to go back in, and his aide had gone out to get the car because walking long distances wasn't good for this particular person. And while the aide was out, three off-duty county sheriffs who had been working as security guards were concerned that he had gone back into the movie theater without paying. Well, the aide came back and explained, you know, that he had a disability and he just really liked the movie and she didn't have any money to pay for him again, and that to go up and confront him wasn't a good idea because when he's touched, he becomes angry and might start cursing. And she said that she had called Mr. Saylor's mother and she could either pay for the ticket and let him watch again or assist him getting out of the theater because of her relationship with him. Unfortunately, the officers disregarded the aide's request, and they approached Mr. Saylor, said he needed to leave the theater. He didn't want to leave the theater. He wanted to watch the movie again. He just didn't understand the issue. He has an IQ of 40. And the officers disregarded what the aide had said and went ahead and grabbed him, didn't wait for the mother to come back, dragged him out of the theater, telling him he was going to go to jail. They handcuffed him, were on top of him. Ultimately, they fractured his larynx, making it difficult for him to breathe, and soon thereafter he died from asphyxiation. It was just such a sad situation that certainly did not have to go this way. Not surprisingly, a lawsuit was filed raising the typical civil rights claims of Section 1983, but for our purposes of interest is the fact that they actually raised two ADA claims as well. One of the ADA claims was a failure to train, and the other was the failure to modify policies. So in 2014, Rio Cinemas filed a motion to dismiss saying those claims weren't viable under the ADA. The court said there's enough here to let the case go forward under the ADA. And then ultimately they filed, the Rio Cinemas filed for a summary judgment, and the court allowed one ADA claim to go forward and the other one to not go forward. So the one they allowed to go forward was the failure to accommodate, and said that what they were saying was that you should modify your policies and change your practices when you have people with disabilities. And here, the court said, you know, if they just followed the advice of the aide, they could have accommodated this person, even though he was, quote unquote, violating, you know, policies or the requirements to pay for a movie ticket. They could have handled it differently than they would handle it typically when you just ask somebody to leave with the officers. That wasn't a good approach with him. And they said that the fact that there was an expert who talked about that there's model policies out there about how to avoid taking custody of people with developmental disabilities because of the response it had, and that, you know, you can go through alternative means such as getting the authorized caregiver to assist as opposed to using the security guards. And they rejected the arguments that the state made saying, or that Rio Cinemas made, saying that he was going to become violent. The aide said, no, it's not violent. He just would get angry. And also they said that the fact that the officers claimed they had no discretion because the manager said they had to remove him, you know, they could have adopted a less extreme alternative, especially since they were told that the mother was on the way. So they said that a failure to accommodate claim should go forward to trial. But they said we're not going to necessarily allow the failure to train claim to go forward, because in order to maintain a failure to train claim is you have to show deliberate indifference, where the state or the Rio Cinemas was disregarding a known risk, and they had not done that. There was no pattern of similar violations of the ADA from previous situations, and they had never received a request to generate a policy for encounters with people with developmental disabilities. And so the failure to train claim was dismissed, but the failure to accommodate claim was allowed to proceed. There is appeal pending in the case with issues unrelated to the ADA, and a settlement conference is scheduled for 2017, so the case may get resolved. We also wanted to point you to some new Department of Justice guidance, a document that was issued in just this month on criminal justice entities and their interaction with people with disabilities under Title II of the ADA. It's very, very good. If you haven't looked at it yet, I strongly recommend you take a look at it. There's all kinds of links to different agreements and policies and procedures that can be incredibly helpful if you're all involved in interaction with people with disabilities and law enforcement. Excuse me. The next case we wanted to talk about is providing effective communication with people with disabilities via law enforcement. And the two cases we have here are very similar, involving interaction of law enforcement and people who are deaf. Both cases, the South Carolina case and then a case that we'll highlight in a couple pages, both involved deaf detainees, arrestees, who were not given interpreters over an extended period of time. The South Carolina case involved 3 months where he was not given an interpreter, including at his arrest. And in both these cases, the Department of Justice reached comprehensive settlement agreements. We've got a link to the agreement on the South Carolina agreement on this slide. And it's, as you'll see, I won't go through all the details, but there are a lot of specific things that South Carolina is going to do to address this issue, including having an ADA coordinator, revising their policies for training, providing auxiliary aids and services for qualified language interpreters. This is a big one, modifying handcuff policies that allows people to be handcuffed in the front so they can enable sign language or writing. They also go into, sorry about that, the importance of having relationships with one or more qualified oral and sign language interpreters who could be available on a priority basis. And then they talk about the difference between exigent circumstances and non-exigent circumstances. So if it's very exigent, something's, you know, some kind of immediate threat, they say it's okay to use written notes or a non-qualified interpreter. If there's non-exigent circumstances, you need to use a pictogram like the one on the slide that show asking, you know, is the person need an interpreter, yes or no? There's a nice questionnaire, which is listed as Exhibit C to the agreement, with all kinds of questions about what their communication needs are. And then on this next slide, you'll see Exhibit B, a couple different kind of communication cards that South Carolina police officers are going to carry with them now that ask them through pictures what kind of communication style they prefer, as well as some common violations to point to explain to the person who's deaf, you know, why they're being pulled over. You'll also see a link to a very similar case out of Arlington County that DOJ settled as well, with a link to that at the bottom. The last issue I'm going to focus on is a couple of cases that highlight a new trend, which is, do people with disabilities have any independent rights, independent living rights, while they're incarcerated? Sounds sort of odd, right? But a couple of cases have really maybe changed the thinking on this issue. So the New York case is a case involving somebody who used a motorized wheelchair, but the New York Department of Correction banned as a blanket policy any motorized wheelchairs due to safety and security concerns. And instead they said you have to use what are called inmate mobility aids, meaning you have to have other inmates provide you with assistance instead of being able to independently ambulate through a motorized wheelchair. Mr. Wright was an inmate with cerebral palsy who could operate a motorized wheelchair, and he challenged this ban because he wanted to be able to get around the prison independently by using this motorized wheelchair, and he couldn't use a standard wheelchair because of his cerebral palsy and scoliosis. The court found that this blanket policy they had did violate Title II of the ADA. They didn't do a failure. They didn't do an individualized assessment. They just had this blanket policy, and the ADA requires an individualized assessment. So he didn't really have meaningful access to the prison system and to the facility. And what was interesting here is they emphasized that the ADA promotes independent living and self-sufficiency, even in prison, and that these inmate mobility aids was not a way to promote independent living and self-sufficiency. It was promoting dependency. And as a result, he was missing meals and doctor's appointments. And, you know, he couldn't really report if those folks weren't fulfilling their obligation, because it would be like snitching on another inmate, which is sort of taboo in prison. And so they said this whole inmate assistance program was ineffective, also because it required advanced scheduling. The court also pointed out that 30 other states allow motorized wheelchairs, so New York was really in the minority here, and their parade of horribles about all the safety and security concerns was really probably unwarranted, given that all the other states, 30 other states, had figured out how to utilize motorized wheelchairs in the prison context. But I think what's important here is that the thought of independent living and self-sufficiency being an important value even within the prison system. And then the Clemens v. Dart case at the bottom is a very similar case. Instead of having other inmates assist, you had here inaccessible cells and having nurses assist. But the court again said that having a nurse assist you as opposed to just making the cells and the bathrooms accessible, you know, was reducing the plaintiff's ability for independent living, and they actually had a jury verdict here of $95,000 when he fell because of the inaccessible cell. So I think one of the things to take away here is that Title II requires an evaluation of independent living and self-sufficiency even within the prison context, and that you don't even have to ask proactively for this. It doesn't have to be just an accommodation or a request. If it's an obvious need, like the obvious need of an accessible cell, by not providing that, you're violating the ADA Title II through the deliberate indifference standard. So some really progressive types of view of support of people with disabilities, even within the context of the prison system. And with that, I'll turn it over to Rachel to take us home through Title III, and then we'll open up for questions.
Great. So Title III, of course, applies to places of public accommodation. And this year, we've seen a couple of cases that help us understand the contours of what that definition is and what are places of public accommodation. So this first case, the Maggie case out of the Fifth Circuit, asks, well, what about vending machines? Are vending machines places of public accommodation? And here we have an individual who was blind and he tried to use a Coca-Cola machine. He tried at a hospital and at a bus station, but he wasn't able to use the machine itself because it had no tactile or oral features. But he didn't sue the hospital. He didn't sue the bus station. Instead, he sued Coca-Cola itself and said that the vending machine needed to be accessible. Well, Coca-Cola defended the case by filing a motion to dismiss, and it argued that it can't be sued under the ADA because it is not a place of public accommodation, that vending machines themselves are not a place of public accommodation. Well, this argument rang true to the district court, who agreed, found for Coca-Cola, and then also with the Fifth Circuit, who affirmed that decision and also agreed and said, no, a vending machine itself is not a place of public accommodation. So what the court did is it looked at the ADA's definition of place of public accommodation. And again, there's a list of 12 different categories that we look at to decide whether or not any particular entity is a place of public accommodation. And the entity needs to fall within one of these 12 categories. Well, the plaintiff in this case said, well, you know, look at this one list. There's this category called where there's a bakery, a grocery store, a clothing store, et cetera, or other sales or retail establishments. So here, we got it. We have a vending machine as an other sales establishment. But the court analyzed the language of the ADA and it disagreed. What the court said is that, no, when you look at the term sales establishment, it's on this list that follows only physical stores, brick or mortar stores. And vending machines differ. They're not like any of the listed examples. And they even distinguish, they say, look, vending machines are things that are often found inside these listed entities. They're not like these listed entities. So for those familiar with the website, the legal updates about whether websites are places of public accommodation, some of this rationale may sound somewhat familiar to you. The court also looked at the ADA's legislative history and Department of Justice guidance and said, you know, based on that, that there's this concept that the ADA is supposed to be construed liberally, but when the court looked at the legislative history, all the examples in this category also were these brick and mortar stores. And so based on that, the court said, you know, there may be vending machines may be subject to the ADA, but it doesn't mean that it itself is a place of public accommodation. Perhaps the hospital or the bus station is what needs to ensure that the vending machine is accessible. And so here, because we have a case against Coca-Cola, but Coca-Cola doesn't own, lease to, or operate a place of public accommodation, Coca-Cola is not going to be a proper defendant in this lawsuit. Like a lot of the other cases we've talked about today, I'm not sure that this is the end of the discussion. This case also, the plaintiffs in this case asked the Supreme Court to review. They filed a petition in November, and to the best of my knowledge, it's still pending. So perhaps we'll see something else on this. But despite, you know, that the Maggi decision that we just talked about, other courts have also continued to construe the ADA broadly. And one example comes from this Leverson case, which also helps us understand what is a place of public accommodation. And here we ask about, well, what about plasma donation centers? What is a plasma donation center? Well, it's a center that collects donors' plasma. What it does is it draws and it processes donors' blood. It does some, you know, processes, and then it ultimately returns the blood to the donor and then takes and sells the plasma to pharmaceutical companies. This case came about because we have a plaintiff who has borderline schizophrenia and attempted to donate plasma for this fee and it was barred from donation based on his disability. And so the district court filed a lawsuit and went to the district court, and the court said that the plasma donation center didn't fall within one of these 12 categories, and so it wasn't a place of public accommodation. But the individual appealed, and the 10th Circuit reversed and remanded the decision, finding for the plaintiff. And one of the 12 categories that the court looked at was the category that includes a laundromat, dry cleaner, things of that nature, and then it includes a catch-all that says other service establishment. And so the plaintiff here said that, look, this plasma donation center is a place of public accommodation because it's a service establishment. So then the question is, well, what is a service establishment? So what the court did is it took the ADA's language for service and the ADA's language for establishment and kind of combined them into one definition and said that a service establishment is going to be this place of business or public or private institution that by its conduct or performance assists or benefits someone or something or provides useful labor without producing a tangible good for a customer or client. And they also said by looking at that definition, we've got this really broad this broad scope of coverage. And so that's consistent with the ideas behind Title III. The court also said, you know, we're not going to limit the definition of public accommodation to an entity that provides or that receives some form of payment from customers. That was an argument that the Plasma Donation Center was making, that, you know, it was unlike other stores because they were not receiving payment from customers. But the court said, you know, there's really nothing in the language or in the history to suggest this sort of limitation. The court also looked at the legislative history and found that there used to be a version of the statute that said similar service establishment, but had actually dropped the word similar. And so they said that that suggested that we didn't need to have a service establishment that was similar to the list that preceded it. And so based on all of this, the court found that Octa Pharma did meet this definition. It was a service establishment, and therefore it was a place of public accommodation. Usually in our webinars, we talk about some few technology-related cases and settlements. And this is definitely no exception. We've got a couple that we wanted to talk about today. And the first one is the settlement agreement between the American Council of the Blind, its local affiliate, and private individual and the company Netflix. And this agreement talks about whether Netflix needs to provide audio descriptions for users who are blind. And here in this agreement, Netflix agreed to take some steps to increase the access to audio descriptions in both their original content and third-party streaming content. And so they have kind of different standards for what they're going to do for their original content and their third-party streaming content, but they're going to make some efforts to increase their audio description on both of those for both of those services. Netflix also agreed that it was going to make some commercially reasonable efforts to make sure that its discs that it sends out to users have audio description, and then also to ensure that users are aware of which of the titles have audio description. They're going to provide a search and browsing capability so that their content is known to its users. Netflix also agreed that they're going to make their website and mobile application accessible. And we've got some of the standards on this slide. So for those interested in learning more, we have a couple links on the slide that you can definitely check out. For those interested in assistive technology issues on college campuses, you've probably heard of the University of Miami consent decree. As a caveat, this is technically a Title II case, but we wanted to include it here in our other assistive technology cases. And this case was first brought by a student who was blind, and the United States intervened to become a plaintiff as well. So in this case, the plaintiffs challenged the lack of accessible information technology used throughout the university system. And we only have a little bit of information about the consent decree on the slide. The reason why is that this consent decree is exceptionally broad, exceptionally detailed. It's over 50 pages printed out. And it addresses really everything from the accessibility of web content to textbooks to course material. And it addresses everything about how to actually make that happen, including things like an IT procurement policy. We don't have the time to kind of go through each and every aspect of this agreement, but we do want to flag it, and especially encourage those who are participating today from colleges and universities to spend some time with this agreement and use it as a guide for your school. Another quick note about a couple other post-secondary cases involving assistive technology. We wanted to highlight the National Association of the Deaf filed two companion cases against Harvard and MIT. And they assert that these universities have to have captioning for online materials that are provided free to the public, including recordings and speeches of educational materials. And this was a case that was filed last year, and the universities in 2016 filed motions to dismiss, and they argued that Title III doesn't apply to the accessibility of online content, and argued that captioning is a fundamental alteration of the content. Interestingly, they also asked the court to stay this case until the Department of Justice publishes its final rule on website and online video accessibility. Notably, the Department of Justice submitted statements of interest in both of these cases, and we've got links to those statements of interest on this page. And then what happened in 2016 is that the court denied both of these requests from the university. First, they denied the request to stay and said that, you know, the court doesn't need any DOJ regulatory technical expertise to resolve the issues in this case. They're already aware of DOJ's opinion from its statement of interest, and there's a lot of other cases, you know, on this topic. The court also denied the university's motion to dismiss, and so this case, again, is moving forward, and it's going to be an interesting one to help us understand the requirements for providing communication access in the post-secondary community. Another Department of Justice settlement in the post-secondary context from 2016 is this agreement with Princeton University. This agreement also actually arose out of a private lawsuit. There's a lawsuit called WP versus Princeton, and it was a case filed in New Jersey, and it's still pending. So what happened in that case is a student intentionally overdosed on medications and then checked himself into the hospital. And just 3 days later, while the student was still in the hospital, he was barred from his dorms and his classes as a result of this suicide attempt. So this situation, again, is being litigated privately, but the situation prompted the United States to perform a compliance review of Princeton University's policies and practices with respect to reasonable accommodations, with respect to withdrawals and leaves for students with mental health disabilities to ensure that they comply with the ADA. Again, this agreement is resolving the DOJ's compliance review, but the private lawsuit is still pending. So we wanted to highlight just a few of the settlement provisions. Under the terms of the settlement, Princeton agreed that it was going to revise its policies and explicitly describe possible accommodations for students with mental health disabilities, and to make clear that requests can be for academics as well as for things like housing and for dining. Princeton's going to more clearly explain how students can submit these requests for accommodations and the process the college is going to use to review them. Princeton agreed to revise its websites, both its disability service and Office of the Dean, to better direct information to students who may find themselves in need of accommodations, and also to revise their leave policies and practices to be consistent with Title III regulations. And notably, they're going to provide annual training on Title III generally and mental health disability discrimination specifically to all faculty and staff who have any responsibility for both evaluating and deciding reasonable accommodation requests. Another trend we saw in 2016 is the number of settlement agreements that the Department of Justice reached with child care providers across the country to revise their policies for children with type 1 diabetes. And it's interesting, we've seen these decisions or these settlement agreements come both from DOJ and DC and from U.S. attorneys' offices across the country. And so as a little bit of background, children with type 1 diabetes often need assistance monitoring their blood glucose levels, also administering insulin, and in the event of an emergency, administering a medication called glucagon, which is an injection, to be able to attend child care programs. And so these four agreements we have here, the agreements from Texas, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and Illinois, all had to deal with either camps, summer programs, summer camps, after-school programs, or sporting, like recreation events. And the YMCAs had initially declined to provide these types of services and assistance to these kids with diabetes. So all four of them came to a settlement this year, and The settlements have some slight variations, but they all generally include these non-discrimination provisions and a requirement that the WISE are going to modify their policy and adopt diabetes medical management plans to enable students, to enable these participants to say what sorts of needs they need and to provide training to the staff to ensure that their needs are being met. There are also procedures in these agreements for fielding and responding to requests for this medication. Most of them are adopting ADA compliance officers, of course, having this training. And then there's some oversight by DOJ. And we want to highlight that one of the agreements also includes a monetary component, $10,000 payment to the complainants. So our final topic today is another kind of hot topic in the world of ADA litigation, and that is ADA and ride sharing. How does the ADA apply to ride sharing technologies such as Uber and Lyft? And last year we highlighted a case against Uber that was brought by the National Federation of the Blind of California, and they alleged that Uber was violating the ADA by refusing to transport service animals or guide dogs. And a couple of the allegations in the complaint were that when approached, drivers were shouting no dogs and leaving or just refusing to accept passengers who had service animals. Last year we told you that in 2015 the court denied the Uber's motion to dismiss and said that the plaintiff's claim could move forward. And what happened this year is that the parties reached a settlement. They first announced a settlement in April, preliminary approval was granted in July, and then final approval was granted in December. So we wanted to highlight a few of the terms of the settlement. Uber drivers are going to expressly confirm that they understand their legal obligations to transport riders with service animals. And so instead of just, they're going to have to affirmatively state that they understand, which will hopefully make sure that the training is being done in a more effective way. Uber is also planning to revise its enforcement policies. And what they're going to do is if Uber receives a complaint and finds that a driver knowingly denied a person a ride due to a service animal, you know, knowing that the person had a disability and they had a service animal and still denied their ride, that person is going to be removed from the system. There's also an enforcement policy that if Uber finds that there have been two complaints that a driver denies a ride, even if the driver didn't know, didn't intend to do it, that driver is still going to be removed from the platform. So what that means for advocates and people with disabilities is that the complaint process is going to be important, and it's something that if this is going to be in place, individuals should definitely comply with and take advantage of. Other parts of the settlement agreement is that Uber agreed to enhance the response system for complaints and to track their data, and they're going to use testers to evaluate compliance with the terms of this agreement. So again, the NFB case with Uber is about service animals, but there's also this outstanding issue with respect to rideshare technology and rideshare companies about whether or not rideshare companies need to provide wheelchair accessible vehicles. In other words, how are they accommodating individuals who use wheelchairs and require wheelchair accessible vehicles? So far there hasn't been a decision on that, but one case to watch is the Access Living of Metropolitan Chicago versus Uber Technologies case, which was filed just at the end of last year. So Access Living is, of course, the Center for Independent Living in Chicago, and they filed this lawsuit alleging that Uber is failing to provide equivalent service to people with disabilities and really emphasizing its failure to provide wheelchair accessible vehicles. So this case, there was no motion to dismiss filed. It's currently in litigation, and it's definitely another one we encourage folks to monitor, especially given this is a very, very new area of the law. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out in court. So that brings us to the end of our section. I know at this point we have a number of questions. So why don't we get started?
What I can do is answer the Title II questions that we have, and you can maybe take a look at the ones that came in for Title I and Title III while I'm answering those. So one of the questions, and it's a really good one, it points out that I didn't do a great job explaining the parties in the case, was the Saylor case against Regal Cinemas. Remember, that's the case involving the young man who wanted to go to the movie, see the movie twice, and then got removed. The question was, how is Title II, since Regal Cinemas is a Title III, a private corporation open to the public or public accommodation. What I failed to make clear here is that not only were the defendants Regal Cinemas, but also, remember I talked about the security guards who removed him. They were actually county sheriffs who were working there that evening. And so the argument was that the county was responsible for their activities here, not just Regal Cinemas. And so it was actually a hybrid Title II, Title III case because you had a private entity, Regal Cinemas, and then you had some public officials who were at Regal Cinemas who did the activities of pulling him out of the movie theater. So that's why Title II was implicated there. The other question somebody asked was whether or not the Wright case involving the prison and the wheelchair, the motorized wheelchair, saying that you should have the opportunity to do that as opposed to letting other inmates be responsible for what you need in prison, whether we would think that that kind of situation, that analysis, might be applied to other Title II entities. And I think actually it is very likely that it would be. And in fact, the fact that it's applied in the prison context, which is usually, you know, courts are usually very deferential to the prison system and prison officials because of the safety and security issues, that it actually is easier to apply those issues, I think, outside the criminal justice context. So I think any kind of situation where you have somebody wanting to act independently in the context of a Title II entity and the Title II entity saying, no, instead of you either using a motorized wheelchair or having this place be accessible, we're going to have people help you out. That really, again, undercuts the whole concept of Title II and the ADA of people being able to work and interact independently with state and local government activities. And I think there's actually probably a stronger argument that this concept would be applied in non-criminal justice contexts just because of the court's traditional deference to security and safety issues in the criminal justice context. So I think this whole concept of meaningful access that we've talked about in the criminal justice context as well as in the voting context seems to be kind of gathering more and more momentum, that just access to a particular entity, whether it be voting or the criminal justice system or a park district program or whatever it is, that access in and of itself isn't enough. We need to talk about being able to access it independently and privately if it's something like a voting situation, and that's really what we're talking about with meaningful access, not just access for access' sake, but really be able to access it independently and be self-sufficient to the greatest extent possible. So I think as we're seeing this come up in different contexts, we're going to see it emerge, I think, in all kinds of different contexts beyond the ones we highlighted today. Rachel, did you see any other questions that would be able to be answered?
Yeah, I see a few. So why don't I start with a couple of the ones. One question I see is a really great one. It was about the case that I talked about in Maryland about the call center. And the question is, how do we determine whether or not how to meet the standard of undue burden in that case? And what did the court look at? Was it things like experts? Did they look at the cost of comparable call centers? And we don't really know what the jury ultimately turned on. We don't usually get that information from a jury. I can tell you what the Fourth Circuit looked at, and they looked at a lot of the things that this questioner asked. They looked at, they actually had experts that testified about other call centers, and they provided suggested costs, and they ranged one of the suggested, the discrepancy between the suggested costs was like $500,000. So you can see how experts are kind of looking at different things. Another thing that they looked at was the county's budget, and one of the important things was the cost savings that the county actually experienced by consolidating the call center. They said they're ultimately saving $10 million, and so we had to balance that with the cost of making some additional changes to make it accessible. And the other question was whether there's a specific percentage of revenue that meets the undue hardships definition, and there's not. And the ADA is pretty opposed to making any sort of hard and fast rules about percentages when we're determining undue hardship under Title I or undue burden under Titles II or III. And it's always this more kind of case-by-case analysis, individualized approach, and we have to look at the various different factors that the EEOC sets forth. So hopefully that answers that question. We have another question that asks about how we determine the statute of limitations for Title II. And both in Title II and Title III, there is no statute of limitation in the ADA itself, but instead we're told to look to the most analogous state law. And so usually what that is the state's personal injury statute. And so that's why sometimes we see cases differ in different states. In Illinois, we have a 2-year statute of limitations, but I think in other states there may be a different statute of limitations. Barry, anything that's jumping out at you?
There's also a question. There's a question about whether we've seen any service animal in the context of public university dorms. And I remember we had a case involving service animals in dorms before, Rachel. I can't remember if it was a private university or a public university, but I'm not sure that it really matters. I mean, I really think it's, again, you're going to be looking at the typical reasonable modification, like if you have a no pets policy type of situation, whether it's a public university or a private university, that's going to be your analysis. And, you know, generally, that's going to be something I think that would be a reasonable modification of a policy. You might have to balance it between any kind of allergy issues, and you'd obviously have to have an animal that's well trained and provides a service and is not, you know, disruptive and things like that. But I think we can look and see if there are actual cases that we can point you to and send those over to Robin afterwards. I can't remember off the top of my head if there are specific ones we've encountered or not.
Yeah, I think there is one that's coming to my head, but I'm blanking on the exact name. But if someone wants to email me at rachelw@equipforequality, I can get you that information.
So
great. Well, thank you very much, both Barry and Rachel. We're at the bottom of the hour, and I know that there's some questions here that were left unanswered, but that's always a challenge when we've got a lot of information in a short period of time, unfortunately. And you have provided your contact information for follow-up if individuals would like to do that. You will receive an email following the session asking you to complete a short evaluation. Your feedback is very important to us, and we ask you to please fill that out and send it back to us. It will also contain information about how to obtain your certificate of attendance, and we'll repeat the information that Barry provided related to the CLEs from Illinois that they're able to offer you as well. Just a reminder, put on your calendar the next session, which is March 22nd. The topic will be announced. The topic that we had for this was related to the Affordable Care Act, but with the things that are happening right now at the federal level, we're going to hold off a little bit on that one to see what happens with it. And so we're working on an alternative, and we'll be announcing that shortly. So please mark your calendars for that session, and we'll be sending out an email when registration is available. Also, you can go back and always check the website, ada-legal.org. So again, thank you, Barry, and thank you to Rachel for the program today and the content that you presented. And everyone, have a great rest of your day. To disconnect, you can just close the browser and or use the file drop-down menu at the top left-hand of your screen and choose exit. If you're on the telephone, just go ahead and hang up the telephone. Again, thank you very much, everyone, and have a great day.